Det är dags för Motbrus första extra avsnitt. Och först ut är en föreläsning av Peter Gelderlos, inspelat på Café 44 i Stockholm. Peter Gelderlos är en författare som har skrivit flera mycket uppskattade böcker, bland annat How Nonviolence Protects the State, Anarchy Works och senast Learning from Ferguson från 2015. För er som inte vet vad Café 44 är, så är det ett av Stockholms politiska mötesplatser som varit igång ända sedan 1984. Ett café och en scen för punkspelningar och diverse andra aktiviteter. Peter var där den 13 december 2015, alltså på internationella ACAB-dagen, eller som det också kallas, snuthatets dag. Gelderlos pratade om icke-våldets negativa effekter på sociala motståndsrörelser, med sina egna erfarenheter från sin aktivism i Barcelona i Spanien som bakgrund. Föreläsningen är tyvärr helt på engelska, så om någon som lyssnar vill översätta så är ni varmt välkomna. Håll till godo!
So my name is Peter. Thank you all for coming. Thanks to the folks of Café 44 for organizing this. I'm originally from the United States, but since 2007 I've been living in Barcelona, participating in the anarchist movements there. So sometimes when I give a talk about anarchist participation in the social movements and the social conflicts in Barcelona over these last years, the talk lasts for 3 or 4 hours just because there's so much that's happened and so much to go into, but don't worry, I won't inflict that on you tonight. We have a shorter talk scheduled for tonight, and so I'll just be focusing on how anarchist participation in the social conflicts there intersects with or reflects on questions of nonviolence, questions of a diversity of tactics, combative methods, and more revolutionary perspectives of struggle. Before I forget, if I start talking really fast, like, please just let me know and slow me down, because I do sometimes start talking really fast. And if there's any anything that you don't hear, any term that you don't understand, also again, please just ask. Also, just for some background, so we're all on the same page, I'll be talking largely about the situation in Barcelona or the situation in Catalonia. So Catalonia is, the vast majority of it is, within the Spanish state. But just so you know, there's, sort of different levels of government. So Catalonia has a semi-autonomous government. So there is there's sort of a level of power, concentrated there. So there's the Spanish state and then also the Catalan state. And then, it's also important to know, I might refer to the Mossos d'Esquadra. Those are the police of Catalonia, the police force of Catalonia. Just for comparison, it's interesting to point out that, the Spanish police, like the Guardia Civil or the Guardia Nacional, can be thought of as a more, post-fascist police force. Like their heritage, their institutional heritage comes from the fascist years. That's sort of like their training, the way that they function. Of course, Spain, was under a fascist dictatorship until the mid-70s. And so those police, they're very aggressive. They're very hostile. If you're at like a protest in Madrid, then sometimes the police there, they'll just like single you out and start insulting you with like sexist or homophobic insults just to try to pick a fight. And they might sometimes just try to go and beat you up. And on the one hand, that's very intimidating and that's hard to deal with on the streets. But on the other hand, that actually does, create some advantages for combative movements, because you have to learn how to defend yourself. Right? It's much harder to have the idea that the state is there to protect you. You know, the state is there to beat you up, to attack you. The state is extremely racist and homophobic and sexist. And often that also leads to situations, getting out of control, because the police are less disciplined, because they're so hyper-aggressive. And so often, there's actually more disorder in the streets there. The Mossos d'Esquadra, the police of Catalonia, can be thought of as a democratic police force, which is really much scarier, I think, with like a long-term view of anti-capitalist movements. They get their training in the UK, in Germany, in Israel, and they're extremely disciplined, and their perspective is one of containing disorder rather than attacking and suppressing disorder. So anytime there's any sort of manifestation on the streets of some ideas or some movement that they don't want to see, they can sort of make it disappear. They just surround it, they kettle it, they prevent it from, if that protest, for example, tries to attack banks or government buildings or attack other symbols of authority. If it's a protest against the church, for example, in as part of this movement against like the recent anti-abortion laws, if it's a protest against a housing eviction, they do a very good job of just surrounding it and not letting it get out of control, and often doing so without much visible use of force. So yeah, they're actually a quite disciplined police force, and that and other changes were leading to in large parts the pacification of social struggles in Catalonia. When I arrived in 2007, it wasn't a place where there were really rowdy or combative street protests. People talked about this recent history of these really strong movements, but the reality when I got there and started living there was every time anarchists, for example, tried to organize a protest without permission, of course, it would just get surrounded, just kettled by police, and they would just make us wait there, packed in like sardines for hours until they would finally let us go home. And so yeah, so we can talk about this process of pacification, which was an attack on a movement with a really long history of combative tactics, a long history of spreading revolutionary perspectives, right? There's this long continuity of anarchist and other anti-capitalist struggles in the Spanish state, especially in Catalonia. And so people remembered how to struggle, right? It wasn't this constant, like I come from the United States, which is a country of total alienation. And at least when I started becoming an anarchist, it was, all of us were, constantly having to reinvent the wheel, start from scratch, start from zero. And there had been very strong struggles in the United States, but these had been made to disappear. They had been completely forgotten. So one of the things that was very interesting for me that I think anarchists do well there is talk about the importance of historical memory, which is a phrase that isn't even typically used in English, right? Is it memory or is it history? History is the subjective thing that's written down on a list in books, and then memory is a completely subjective, personal thing. So there's this idea of keeping the memory of our struggles alive in the spaces that we create between us and keeping these memories in the streets. So people will still make references to the Civil War and to this near revolution that almost happened. They'll still make references to the dictatorship and how the dictatorship transitioned very smoothly into a democratic system. The fascists just became the conservative party. The socialists and the communists sold out in exchange for power to become the socialist party. And then they just split the cake between them at a time when there were wildcat strikes and factory takeovers and riots every week in the streets at a time of really strong revolutionary struggles. So it was very obvious to people that democracy was brought in to defuse this potentially revolutionary situation that had really blown up after 1968. So even though I might speak of pacification, this was a more short-term phenomenon, people still remembered what it means to struggle. People still remembered how to struggle. Sometimes, you know, some of the older folks, like 40 and 50 years old, or not even that old, would sort of make fun of us younger anarchists, saying, people these days, they don't even know how to make a Molotov cocktail. That's a huge problem because, you know, in my day, and they're talking about maybe a period very recently, just in the 90s, when there were, for example, in the neighborhood of Besos, big struggles against sort of incipient processes of gentrification or evictions or attempts to assert more state control in these very proletarian neighborhoods. That's how neighbors would defend themselves. And it was just a fact. So the fact that, Molotov cocktails as one easily cliched symbol of struggle had disappeared for a few years, the memory hadn't disappeared. And there were still old people who had used them, who knew how to make them, who would make fun of, you know, these younger less radical anarchists. Of course, using that term ironically because it's radicality isn't a function of how combative the tactics are that we use. But it's just funny for me because it's a reversal of the typical dynamic where it's like, you know, the old people who are always very conservative and the young people who get all crazy. But that started changing in I think it's important to point out it's easy to identify the change in 2010. Right, which is the year when austerity measures were first announced. But I think at a theoretical level, it's important to note that certain very, very important changes, albeit small, like on the surface they appear to be very small changes, were already appearing in the years immediately before that, 2009, 2008, 2007. criticisms within these anti-capitalist movements of ways that we had sort of isolated ourselves into these bubbles, how we weren't very present in social conflicts, and how we weren't seeking out these social conflicts to participate in this sort of potential gap, in this potential rupture in the image of democratic peace, in the image that, you know, everything's fine here, we're a country of laws, and everything works out, and if there's any problem, you can just use the tools that the system offers you to make a change. So immediately before that, anarchists already were sort of leaving their shells a little bit to participate in these social conflicts, to make these gaps visible and to make them wider. One quick note, also throughout this talk I'll be speaking about anarchists. That's because I identify as an anarchist. I'm sure many people here don't. None of these movements are homogenous, right? In all these movements, there are anarchists, there are people who identify as radical feminists, there are people who identify as socialists, as anti-capitalists. So I'm speaking from a sheerly subjective perspective. At the same time, though, I wouldn't call this an individual perspective, because all the things I'm talking about, ideas aren't created by one single person. So all of these things that I'm sharing are things that we came up with together in our debates, in our discussions, in our protests, in our organizing. Yeah, that's important to point out. So I'll be speaking about, you know, anarchists, because that's what I'm coming from, but that's definitely not, you know, these spaces of social conflict are quite heterogeneous there. And secondly, in these years immediately prior to 2010, there also was, you were starting to see an increase in more combative, more illegal methods. One great example is there was a campaign to get this long-term anarchist prisoner, Amadeu Casillas, who had spent many, many years locked up, to get him out. And there was a really wide range of tactics used in solidarity with him, from protests, legal action, like the CNT got him lawyers to make appeals. And then there were also attacks, sabotage actions, protests against the prison administration for a period of time. Many, many banks were smashed. Police vehicles were attacked, roads were blocked, and these sort of actions organized by small people, like these moments of weakness when you can't take over a whole city, but a small group of people moving fast can actually accomplish quite a lot and can really ridicule this image that the state is all powerful, that the state with all its security cameras and all its cops can control the streets. So these changes were already happening before the crisis landed, so to speak, in Spain. And I think that's important, that these sort of material economic conditions didn't cause this change in our struggles. But the change became obvious in 2010, the year that the first austerity measures were announced, with the preparation of a general strike. So the major unions, once these sweeping austerity measures were announced, does everyone know the term austerity? Okay, great. So yeah, austerity is basically like when the government is like making cutbacks and slashing funding for social services. For it can be with privatizations, it can be with other forms, but basically, yeah, this neoliberal politics that they're doing in an increasing number of countries now. So once the government announced these austerity measures, the two major unions in Spain were sort of obligated to call a general strike. These are unions that they receive money from the government. They have full-time bureaucrats who they're getting paid by the government. And for a long, long time, they haven't really done anything good within these social struggles. They more just try to control struggles, to pacify them. But in those circumstances, they had to at least make a show of resistance. And it's interesting because on the one hand, a general strike can be a very promising opportunity for these social movements. But on the other hand, it's also quite compatible with a more spectacular method of struggle, because in the end, it's one day. It might turn into huge riots. It might shut down the economy. It might blockade an entire city. But it's usually just one day of this outpouring of anger and emotion. And then that often makes it easier for people the next day to go back to normality, to go back to work, and to have the feeling that they've done something, that they've tried, so that these union bureaucrats can then negotiate with the government and sign off on the austerity measures, which is exactly what happened. These two major unions, after the one general strike, they approved the austerity measures. But this time, the general strike went down a little bit differently, because it wasn't only these majority unions that were organizing it, right? There were also all these other spaces of struggle that were participating. On the one hand, there were smaller unions, like the CGT or the CNT with an anarcho-syndicalist background, which are much smaller, but still have some presence. Some other unions, but also, and really interesting for me, in Barcelona at least, some neighborhood assemblies appeared. At first only in 6 neighborhoods. Later, as events went on, he spread to about 20 neighborhoods with like 200 or 300 people participating in each one. And so in these neighborhood assemblies, people, and there were like I was participating in the assembly in my neighborhood. There were like a couple of us anarchists, but then, you know, many other people who identified in different ways. So they were very open spaces. And we started preparing for these general strikes. A lot of what we were doing was like propaganda, like spreading, spreading a different idea of what a general strike means. To say that a general strike isn't just a protest. A general strike means, shutting down the economy. It means shutting down the city. It means fighting to take over streets. It means shutting down businesses that are refusing to participate in the general strike, or that aren't letting their workers participate in the general strike. So it's also important to point out that a general strike isn't democratic, right? If there's a workplace in your neighborhood that's not going to participate in the general strike, you don't just say, you know, okay, that's your choice. You go and you shut them down. So actually, for this general strike, there were pickets organized in lots of different neighborhoods by groups of neighbors themselves, who in the weeks in advance had gone around to their neighborhood talking to workers at businesses all throughout the neighborhood to find out which places were going to participate in the general strike, and especially where were the bosses threatening their workers not to participate in the general strike, to make sure to go there the morning of the strike and shut them down, or maybe even the night before glue their locks so that they couldn't open up. And that's actually, one thing that was sort of interesting in terms of like different ideas that these sort of democratic values were often used to pacify these movements. And it's very easy to argue, oh, you know, this picket or these people making this general strike are being very authoritarian because they're forcing other people to participate. To which we often responded that these aren't individual realities. This is a collective reality that we all face together. And every single shred of privilege or benefits or the slightest thing approaching some kind of decency or lack of precarity in a workplace is owed to these tactics, right? So like the fact that people have vacations, the fact that people maybe only work 8 hours a day, whatever their salaries are, the fact that they have access to healthcare is only because people were using these tactics in the past. So you can't really renounce these tactics. It wouldn't be coherent anyways to renounce those tactics without also voluntarily offering to work 20 hours straight, to work without any vacation days, and to give up your healthcare. That first general strike was very successful. It had a very high level of participation. There were actions early in the morning, blocking the major entrances and the train lines into Barcelona to paralyze transportation. And the pickets that went around in different neighborhoods, shutting down many workplaces, especially targeting like these big businesses and big malls and things like that. And then there was a major protest in the day. Another space of organization was this more sort of activist assembly that occupied the old State Bank building right in Plaza Catalunya to create a physical symbol of the power of the strike to let people know that this wouldn't just be a protest. I'm occupying the old State Bank building in the very center of the city to create La Casa de la Vaga, or like the House of the Strike, which was sort of a temporary social center that would give out information about what was going on, allow people to organize, and encourage people to participate in the strike. When police evicted that occupation the day of the strike, rioting started, and there was actually pretty heavy fighting with police. And that was one of the first times in a number of years that people were actually fighting for control of the streets. Since I had arrived in Barcelona, its impressive reputation notwithstanding, rioting in Barcelona had actually been people seeing how much stuff they could smash until the police come and then running away from the police, because no one had developed the ability to stand up against the Mossos de Esquadra in the streets. Like I said, they're a very competent police force. It's very disciplined and very good at preventing disorder or stopping people who are engaging in illegal tactics. And this was one of the first, and it helped that there were more than 100,000 people in the streets. And so this is one of the first times that people were really fighting back. As some comrades from Greece were trying to communicate when they were sort of digesting the lessons of the insurrection in 2008 and talking about this to comrades from other countries, in these situations, it's much more important to attack the police rather than to attack the banks, because if you can attack the police, then you can do everything. And so there's this important issue about the control of space and what we're able to do when we can take over space. And that sounds like, well, yeah, just to go ahead and use the word, it sounds like really like a violent idea. But it's important that all of the things that, that even many progressives and many pacifists valued about these social movements in, especially in Barcelona, but across the Spanish state, were only possible because of that degree of combativity, right? The, all the assemblies in the plazas were only possible because people could take over a plaza, because there was this readiness to fight for those spaces. All of the social centers and the squats that do beautiful things, like they make gardens and they have arts and crafts workshops and carpentry workshops and metal workshops and circus workshops and libraries, and all of that is directly related to a practice of fighting the state and fighting the police. And we had seen in Barcelona when I got there, there was this slogan, desalojos disturbios, evictions, riots, which had been true in the 90s, certainly, in like the early aughts, the early, whatever the name is, of the first decade of this millennium. But it wasn't really true anymore. It had sort of just become an empty slogan, or to put it optimistically, a wish, a desire that people weren't currently realizing. The more accurate slogan would be, an eviction, another occupation. Or as some of us would sort of joke when we would have these little protests trying to stop an eviction, which meant like you get a call at 7 a.m, hey, the police are evicting my house, like please come help. And then every day, you know, every time fewer and fewer people come out because you just get exhausted and like the police don't let you get away with anything. And then you're just 30 people in the street watching the cops kick your friends out of their house, and it doesn't matter like if they've been how long they've been living there. It doesn't matter if they have a baby. None of that matters. They're just one day they're out of the house, and you can't really do anything. We sort of cynically joke with each other. Rewrite the slogan to say evictions equals moving day. But at least people kept squatting. They kept going at it, even though they had sort of lost that ability. And when I was there, people were definitely talking about it. Very soon squatting wouldn't be possible anymore in Barcelona. And I think if we hadn't seen this explosion of more combative methods in the streets, it would be done already. All the squats would have been evicted. Yeah, so this general strike went surprisingly well, measured in a variety of ways. And then after that, more things started happening. There were more general strikes called. On May Day of 2011, instead of doing just the usual route through the center so all the tourists can just gawk at you and take pictures, or the selfie stick version, people decided, and this was a broader anti-capitalist protest with anarchists and other kinds of anti-capitalists, for example, from like the left wing of the Catalan independence movement, decided to go not through the center, but through a couple of rich neighborhoods of Barcelona, Sarrià, Sant Gervasi, and people just destroyed everything. Like, all of the banks, all the luxury stores, luxury cars got set on fire. So many windows were destroyed, in that short march that it took almost a week. Like, there weren't enough. I'm not sure what the term is for what's the name of the people who fix windows, glass mechanics. There just weren't enough glass mechanics in the city to fix all these windows, so that people in these rich neighborhoods, people who were benefiting from austerity, people who were benefiting from the fact that, you know, now like the hospital that I would go to like when I get sick is getting closed down, or like my friend is now thinking about taking her kid out of school because the public school is complete bullshit now because of public school is always bullshit, but it gets even worse when there's less funding because of these austerity measures. The people who are benefiting and profiting off of this, at least for 1 week, have to see that the war has come home. They have to see some of the consequences of what they're doing to all of us. And it was very interesting because one of the common arguments of at least some, if not many, advocates of nonviolence is that violence alienates people. Violence scares people away. And like in my experience, pretty much all of the arguments of nonviolence, and when I talk about nonviolence, I'm not talking about someone whose personal participation in these struggles doesn't use what could be called violent tactics. I think that's great and that's necessary, and there's room for everybody in our struggles. Well, not everybody, but anyways. A lot of people. When I speak about nonviolence, I'm referring to an attempt to impose one exclusive set of tactics on an entire movement. To say these set of tactics are acceptable and all these are not. Not that I don't like riots. I like gardens, and I want to my participation in this movement to have to do with like gardens and feeding people or healing people. I'm definitely not referring to that. I'm only referring to people who say like who are trying to protect the banks, protect the police, and so forth. So they'll often say that violence scares people away, and often the media spectacularize riots in a way that can generate fear, or at the least in a way that, you know, that sells newspapers, which I suppose is an outdated concept. But, if, for example, the easiest example would be, you know, these sort of summit protests, right? Many people in the streets don't know what the G20 is, or they don't know much about the World Bank. And so maybe it doesn't immediately make sense, like, why all of a sudden, like, a few thousand people come to this one city and start destroying things. This can actually be attractive to, like, a lot of people. I know that when, like, the World Trade Organization Seattle, the riots happened in Seattle in 1999, I was extremely attractive to that. Like, it was really, I mean, in, like, the sort of social morass, the social isolation of the United States, it was the first time I realized that there were other people out there who hated this world, who thought that this system that we're forced to live in is poisonous. But it still is easier to sort of not understand, like, what's going on, and to sort of portray it as, like, a circus or a carnival. But when a group of people, when there's austerity measures happening, go through a rich neighborhood and destroy everything, it doesn't matter how the media spins that, everyone will immediately understand what's going on. And the media covered up this riot. They tried to make it disappear. So, for example, you would get reporters going to the other side of Sarria, the other side of this neighborhood, saying, yes, there were some reports of scuffles earlier with police, but as you can see, the streets are calm, everything is fine here, nothing is happening. What if they had just gone 10 blocks that way? They would have seen, like, Mercedes on fire and, like, you know, banks with, like chunks of paving, so it's, like, this big, like, lodged in plate glass windows. And so they tried to make this disappear because they knew how popular that would be. They knew how many people would be attractive to that vision of struggle. So, yeah, a lot of these, I sort of had a sentence fragment earlier. I was saying that, in my experience, most of the arguments in favor of nonviolence use a very ambiguous category, which is violence. What is violence, right? I don't think it's a strategically useful category. If it's a category that places in the same box, things like someone fighting to defend themselves, someone burning a bank, someone fighting with cops to try to stop an eviction, or things that governments do, like carpet bombing a city, or evicting people, kicking people out of their houses when they have nowhere else to go, or raising food prices, knowing that some people won't be able to afford food anymore. All of these other things that happen. Advertising that like enforces like the certain body image. And in fact, these latter things, which actually do much more damage than rioters, are often not thought of as violence because they're more invisible. Part of the nature of the category of violence is it's easier to identify as violent, that which is more shocking, that which is abnormal to us, outside of the normal. And everything that we do to try to change this system is most definitely much, much less normal than everything that the system does in a very invisible, silent way every single day to enforce its power. So I prefer not even to talk about violence. I don't think it's a useful category for analysis. We can talk about peaceful tactics and combative tactics, for example, but it's a very ambiguous category. So you can say, well, violence scares people away. And since you're making an affirmative statement, it's easier to think of an example that in which that's true. So you think violence, you know, someone runs in here like screaming and like throwing glass bottles, like that would be kind of scary. I would certainly try to run away through that door. But it's that's not true in very different circumstances. For example, people going and smashing a rich neighborhood in these circumstances. 2 weeks after this protest, the 15th of May movement, or the Plaza Occupation movement, occurred all throughout the Spanish state. People took over their plazas. They started making assemblies. That was a very, very, there was a movement with lots of different currents, lots of different ideas informing people's participation. But one curious thing about it is it brought hundreds of thousands of people into the streets who hadn't participated in social movements before. And so often in the past, in fact, I also had thought that a lot of these questions about violence and nonviolence were just cultural. Okay, the United States, because of its culture, is going to have more pacifism, but Spain has a long history of these anti-capitalist struggles, so nonviolence just doesn't exist there, right? Because it had these like historical struggles. But one thing that was very interesting made me believe that actually nonviolence is universal to democratic societies. Anywhere that you have a democratic society, good citizens or people who fulfill this role of being normal people, right, following the norms of their society, which in a hierarchical society are coming from the top, are being constantly trained in nonviolence, or more precisely, to accept the structural violence of the system, but to oppose anything that especially the media would define as violence in our social movements, or rather anything that we ourselves would do, any tools for struggle that we would take into our own hands. And that this was confirmed overwhelmingly in Barcelona, in a city where just 2 weeks ago you had this protest that the media had to cover up that was smashing windows, and how many months is that? Like 8 months earlier, you had a general strike with hundreds of thousands of people participating and some heavy rioting. But now you get hundreds of thousands of other people who hadn't been participating before in these movements. And in that circumstance, it was extremely easy to impose a very extreme form of nonviolence. And at least in my experience, I saw a very clear difference. People who had participated in movements before were open to a diversity of tactics, to using more illegal and more combative tactics, and people who were coming down into the streets for their first time believed in the fundamental values and ideas of nonviolence. So that was one thing. So there's cliche that nonviolence is a revolutionary thing because our society constantly trains us in violence. It's not true. Our society trains us, if we're doing it, to allow the state to continue to exercise a monopoly on violence. Then there's another thing. Violence is a category that's defined overwhelmingly by the media, not by us. Other concepts like liberation or freedom maybe are things that we talk about more and that we have more influence in defining because the people in power don't want us to think as much about liberation, freedom, things like that. They want us to think about shopping. They want us to think about security above all these days. So we have more influence. But they're talking all the time about this category of violence, and so they're redefining it. So one of the arguments against nonviolence is that it will inevitably go from more confrontational tactics that were used, for example, in the civil rights movement in North America, in the nonviolent part of the movement for the liberation of India from British colonialism, for example, because that was a movement with a great diversity of tactics, with also armed groups and all the rest. But the official histories have made all those disappear. So now when we think India, we only think Gandhi, even though he's just one small part of it. They'll go for more confrontational methods like that use maybe even sabotage, that use blockades, that use boycotts and things like that, to the most pacified, watered-down, extreme forms of nonviolence imaginable, because violence isn't a category that we control. So therefore, nonviolence in the end is sensitivity to the needs and the fears of the elite as projected through the media. A great example, there are plenty of examples of that from Plaza Catalunya, from the Plaza occupation. One of the best is there was a group of people, I used the example of gardening before, who wanted to turn a part of Plaza Catalunya into a guerrilla garden, right? The grassy area, make a garden there. All of the nonviolence activists came and said, no, you can't do that, that's violence, because it's against the law. And so they just like summed it up. In the end, at the end of this slippery slope, violence is anything that violates the law. So that was an extremely distressing experience. That I thought I was in this place where there was a strong history of these struggles, like a shared use of these more effective, more combative methods of struggle. And then all of a sudden, we're still in the streets, but other people are coming in the streets saying that we can't do the things that we'd always done. Like even like spray painting banks in protests. Like in a protest, that's the function of a bank, to be, a billboard for our struggles, right? That's why it's there in that moment. And then all of a sudden there were these people who were coming with like this completely different conception of like physics and the laws of nature, saying that, no, that's someone else's property. You can't do that. It was a very strange and in the beginning disempowering experience. And we decided to stay in the streets and confront it. Some of us anyways, me and my closer friends, decided to stay in the streets and confront it, rather than surrendering ground to that concept of struggle. But there were also other things. There were also events well beyond us that led to nonviolence being overcome very quickly. I want to mention some of those first. In the beginning, the 15M movement, they tried to call it the Indignados movement, but I don't really like that that phrase because, I and many others, we feel much, much more than indignant. We feel quite angry, and also with our own ideas, with our own projections. It pretended to model itself on the Arab Spring, on these uprisings in particularly Egypt and Tunisia, but it was extremely paternalistic, superficial, and within the circumstances, I would even go so far as to say racist, because there was no attempt whatsoever to actually learn from those struggles, and certainly not to enter into a solidaristic relationship with them, but to spectacularize them, or rather to use the spectacle that the media had already created to confirm or to support preconceived ideas of struggle, right? So in Cairo, in the revolutionary movement there, people burned something like 90 police stations. People defended themselves from the thugs of the state. They learned how to make their own gas masks. They fought on the streets in order to hold space. And that wasn't talked about, right? Instead, the nonviolent activists from the 15M movement gave us this vision that it was a nonviolent movement, which is what Barack Obama called it, but it certainly wasn't the case in the streets. For example, in one of the anarchist social centers in Barcelona, a comrade from who had been there, who was from that area and had contacts there and spoke Arabic, was able to organize like a Skype talk with comrades from Tahrir Square, and we were able to make this contact. We looked for ways to send them to support, especially around the internet blockade and things like that, and to learn from them and to also help them to create this reciprocal mutual relationship. But what was going on with the 15M movement, or at least the pacifist parts of it, was completely one way. It was a colonial relationship. We're going to take from you what we want, and as far as we're concerned, you don't exist. There weren't these real attempts at solidarity, and certainly not attempts to actually learn from what was going on there. It was also, I think, not only insulting, but perhaps dangerous, that they refer to this as a movement that had finished, that had already won. They used nonviolence, it worked, they're free now. They got rid of the dictatorship. Whereas all the people that we were in touch with there were very clear, it's not over, the struggle is still going on. And now in retrospect, given how things have progressed there, we can see that that's certainly the case. So that's one thing. They did this tactic, but because more and more relationships of international solidarity are spreading these days, and because there were more and more contacts, also people traveling a lot, like within the sort of Mediterranean world, it became actually easier to learn from these other struggles. So on the one hand, people at first were attracted by the spectacular image of the Arab Spring and other uprisings, but quickly started to realize that no, more combative methods were being used in these places, so maybe we should learn from that and also do that here. Another thing, at a certain point, the police decided to evict Plaza Catalunya, and they tried to defend themselves nonviolently using nonviolent tactics, and it became apparent that that didn't work, that you can't hold space with nonviolent tactics from an enemy who is willing and able to use a great deal of violence against you. A lot of people had their arms broken, people got pepper sprayed, people got kicked out. The police just pushed them from one end of the plaza to another. And people realized that that's not actually dignified. It's not dignified to sit there and let cops break your arm. In fact, it's quite traumatizing. Speaking of trauma, I think it's very interesting. Some friends of mine have a couple different healthcare projects, like anarchist healthcare projects in Barcelona. And there's been a lot of studies, especially in recent years, about trauma and also about how emotions sort of reside in muscles. So you can have like muscular tension that's related to traumas or to different specific emotions. So a lot of people actually break this sort of Western divide between like the mind or emotions in the body by like doing these therapies that work, both like emotional processing and also like muscular processing, like massages and stuff like that. And for example, there's people who talk about, shortly after living through a traumatic experience, like you can have like a sort of like physically demand, like an activity that used a lot of muscles, or and then there's even like schools that talk about specifically like this like corporeal reaction of like trembling, of like just is like a way of like actually like exercising trauma and getting it out. And I think like in like fighting in the streets and fighting back, like actually sitting here like immobilizing yourself, is often, I think, a response that locks trauma into your body rather than helping you process it in a healthy way. Yeah, just speaking like of my own experience in like situations where like you like receive like physical violence and like people are like trying to beat you or something like that, or even like a situation with like an abusive housemate who's like constantly like threatening other people in the house. At a certain point, like deciding to like end dialogue and just to physically fight back can be an extremely healing experience. And I think that's also important to talk about. And has some interesting parallels in some things that Franz Fanon talks about when he was studying and really participating in the war in Algeria against French colonization.
So these nonviolent tactics didn't allow people to hold on to space. So people started giving up on them. And then one of the things that we did to challenge this nonviolence was, like I said, we stayed in the streets and we looked for what you could think of as like the point of like optimum conflict, right? We decided not to do things that would be so conflictive and so shocking to other people that they would break our connection, that they would break the relationship. But we were trying to do things that would be shocking to them, with this idea that conflict is actually a very good thing. Conflict is healthy, and conflict helps us learn. It's necessary for learning in our struggles. And in my opinion, that was actually the more radical thing to do than some of these other people who, you know, have this very radical image, but think, oh, you know, I'm not going to participate in that space because it's full of reformists, so I'm just going to go somewhere else. In the beginning, in these major protests that were coming out of the Plaza Occupation movement, that point of conflict was like spray painting banks. Right, that was like extremely shocking to some people, and people would throw themselves in front of the bank to protect the bank, or they would even attack you. There were many, many cases of people like, you know, attacking you or hitting you in the name of nonviolence. So then, in order to spray paint a bank, what needed to happen was you would say have two people with the spray paint, but then like six or eight people sort of protecting them, right? Kind of behind them and not letting other people like stop the spray painting action. And that was really interesting because at first the people would go up and try to like physically attack the spray painters, but then they saw, they have friends who are protecting their backs. So, and they weren't organized enough to take on these six people. So then what they would do next, their next choice, after physical violence was dialogue. They would start arguing, saying, you know, you can't do that. You know, that's private property. You're giving us a bad image, et cetera, et cetera. And then something happened that was for them very surprising, was that these people who were often like masked up argued back, talked back, and gave their reasons for spray painting these banks, and talked about, you know, why this is necessary, why this is okay. And that was surprising because these pacifists had expected, you know, to meet sort of like these like brute monsters who were like, you know, I was drinking with some friends before, you know, before this protest, and so we just caused mayhem. And they were also surprised to see that their assumptions that the people who were doing these things would all be young hooligan-y men were also quite false. So that's one thing that happened. And then another thing that happened is, in the beginning when this wasn't done, and there were people arguing against spray painting, for example, you would get the feeling that the whole crowd was against you, that the whole crowd had these pacifist beliefs. But the moment that some people started arguing in favor of this action, first of all, maybe some people who we did know who shared our ideas but who weren't involved would also start arguing in favor of this action from the crowd. But then other people who we didn't know, total strangers, would also speak up, and they would also talk in favor of these more confrontational tactics. And I think that says something interesting about human psychology. If your ideas are not the normal ones, if your ideas aren't the ones that receive legitimacy from these big social structures, you usually don't speak up. You usually bite your tongue. And so then the only ones who are speaking up are the ones who are speaking in favor of the socially dominant values. And so then you get the idea that the whole crowd thinks the same way, that they're all pacifists. But in the minute when you start speaking up in favor of this other way of doing things, you'll find that actually there's a lot of people who agree with you, who in the previous situation didn't feel comfortable or didn't feel empowered to speak up. So that was very interesting. So pretty quickly, the opposition to spray painting, for example, disappeared. And there was pretty rapidly a broad popular support for that kind of activity in the march. And so then people raised the level and they looked for the next thing. Then it was like justifying wearing masks, because many people would say, okay, I don't care if you smash the bank, but why are you wearing masks? You make us look bad. Fortunately, around that time, the government arrested about a dozen people from this movement for a blockade on Parliament, thanks to all of the people going on filming and photographing all of these, photoing all of these protests, and because of the media giving their images to the police. So in that context, it became much easier to talk and to debate about, you know, why anonymity is necessary in these movements, why wearing masks can be a good thing. And then there were also talks about sort of breaking the typical cliches. Instead of, in Barcelona, it's by no means, you know, only like young men who are engaging in these violent activities. There's like a very long, a strong history of radical militant feminism there who are also engaging in these tactics. So that breaks some of the cliches. And then other of the cliches are broken when you know, there's a protest that gets really rowdy and people start smashing banks. And instead of like doing it in like the more like adrenaline infused way of like really, really quickly, if there's a lot of people in the streets and it's a safe situation, safe in the sense that the police don't have the ability to immediately swoop in and arrest people, they'll just walk calmly along the sidewalk and like, oh, they see like, you know, someone shopping passing by. Oh, excuse me, you know, this bank is about to get smashed, so you might want to step aside. You know, don't be alarmed. Just calmly, like calmly smashing and totally like breaking these sort of stereotypes. And so, yeah, quite quickly, actually, the level of acceptable confrontation was pushed up. Less than a year after the Plaza Occupation Movement started, there was the next big general strike on the 29th of March, 2012. So just 10 months later. And that time, there was even huger participation because you had all the people participating from before, plus a lot of new people who had come into this from the Plaza Occupation Movement. And this was like the most combative day yet. You had blockades in the morning, like burning tire barricades, shutting down like the major roads coming into town, sabotages of like the train lines to shut those down, pickets going around the neighborhood, like I mentioned, like closing down these businesses that had been threatening their workers, and then a big protest that smashed all of the banks and luxury shops on this luxury street. And then one really interesting thing happened in the evening. Still at no point had the people been able to stand up to police, right? The smashing that people were doing, it was because there were so many hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, the police couldn't be everywhere. Still, when the police attacked, people just ran away. But then in the afternoon, you had about 100,000 people gathered in Plaza Catalunya. So that, actually, that sort of geographical juxtaposition was really interesting. You know, the fact that, you know, what had become sort of the center of pacifism 10 months later became the point where this really important battle happened. So I was really curious to see it in the same place. You had all these people there, and clearly lots of people wanted, they wanted to be able to kick the police out of that space. They wanted to rise up in some way, but no one knew how to, or we were all afraid to take the first steps. And it actually happened by coincidence that someone had sort of set some dumpsters on fire, pushed them towards the police, and then like run away really quick. And the cops just stayed there, like guarding this major shopping mall. But then this dumpster fire grew and grew and grew to the point that it got so hot that the police had to withdraw their riot vans in order to keep the riot vans from also catching fire. And so then just this little tiny tactical retreat, the people saw it. And just spontaneously, 1,000 people rushed forward and chased the police and chased them a couple of blocks, kicked them out of the plaza. And then from that moment on, it was like the spark that people had been waiting for. And this entire mass of people took over that space in a new way, started, you know, smashing banks, burned a Starbucks, fighting with police and so forth. And this time when police counterattacked, people didn't run away. They held their ground. They you know, made shelters or took shelter behind these construction barricades because police were shooting a really high number of rubber bullets. Like, for it seemed like an hour that there was like this line of police shooting at like this quite high volume, like of like bam 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 bam, like quite constantly for a really long amount of time. And these aren't like the soft foam bullets, but like the hard rubber bullets that, like, I mean, several people like had punctured lungs, lost their spleens, lost eyes. So like a very dangerous situation, and people were staying there rather than leaving that area. And then also, like, you know, breaking up a bunch of rocks and throwing rocks at police, so it was dangerous for the police to advance. It took the police, I think, more than an hour to clear that area out, but they could only really just push it to other places. So part of the crowd moved up to Aixampla, where, like, you know, throughout the next few hours, fires were appearing here and there. And then another part went down to Raval, which is the main immigrant neighborhood that's in the center of Barcelona. And that was very curious because lots of people, some of them who had been in the protest and others who hadn't, from this immigrant neighborhood, started like setting small trash fires, and they would make their pile of rocks. They would get their rocks ready, and then they would set a small trash fire, hoping that the police would come, so they could throw the rocks at the cops and take revenge for so many years of raids in the metro, of identifications, of deportations, of beatings, of racist insults, and all the rest. Early on in the night, a couple undercover cops were caught in that neighborhood and beat up and kicked out. And for the rest of the night, the police didn't enter that neighborhood. It was a liberated zone for an entire night. But one really significant thing happened in this fight here in Plaza Catalunya. I mentioned the people who were throwing rocks. This was you know, I don't know, 1,000 people, a couple thousand people, something like that, which is a really large number for fighting the police. But there are thousands of riot police in Barcelona. And like I said, they're very, very competent, right? In normal circumstances, they just would have attacked from behind and, you know, beaten these people up, made them run away, made some arrests and controlled the situation. They couldn't do that because this wasn't a riot of 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people. This was a riot of 100,000 people. All of the people who were there in the plaza were participating in some way or another. And that at least provides me with what I think is a very important metaphor for our struggles and for how to make these struggles stronger. And it also breaks with some certain like value hierarchies that we had been using previously. Because all these other people who weren't throwing rocks, what were they doing? Some of them were like helping break up the pavement to carry rocks to the front. Some of them were helping injured people come back to a safer place in the middle of the plaza. So there were also some people who didn't like the riding and they were there like, you know, arguing against it. But so then some other people were debating with them and arguing with them so that they wouldn't stop what was going on. There were many people who were just like cheering every time, like, you know, when the Starbucks got lit on fire, for example, or when people attacked the police. And that's, for me, I realize that that's not like a passive form of participation. Because when you're going up against like a totally armored, armed riot cop and you're by yourself, you're weak, you're afraid, you know, you'll get like, you know, little old me against like this, you know, big old like beating machine. What am I going to do? But when you have all these people, not even behind you, with you, it like creates this collective force, this collective strength, which completely, it totally changes the situation. It also makes the police more afraid, right? One thing is, imagine, you know, you're a riot cop, you know, you think you're like the, you know, hottest jerk in town and like super tough and you go to the gym and everything like that and you have total impunity. You could even kill people and you wouldn't go to prison. And you're up against like, okay, 1,000 black clad, masked rioters. That's one thing. But then when there's this sea of 100,000 people, like, pouring out hatred towards you, you're not going to want to attack that whole group of people. That's like at that point, the police get afraid. And that's also why the police in certain moments retreated and ran away. There were also other ways of participating as well. There were people who were just there. There were old people there. There were people with little children there who decided not to run away. When the fighting started, they decided that it was important for them to be there. You know, because they wanted to be there, they wanted to take part. Maybe they wanted their children to be there. They wanted to be able to tell their children, like, that day in that general strike, when we stood up to the state, you were there. And that's really important. So that, like, I think in the past, lots of anarchists, we had sort of given all the importance to, like, the sort of, like, this front line of struggle, right? The people who are there, like, throwing rocks, fighting with the police. And I really strongly disagree with some of these discourses that say that that's, like, an exclusive activity that only like privileged people can do. Like there are so many examples. I mean, people without papers, trans struggle. I mean, in the United States, at least, like the queer and trans struggle really blew up from a riot. People with like different abilities, like all of these struggles have had their moments of fighting against police. Like anyone can, but that's also not the point because there are many legitimate reasons to choose not to. And that should also be valid. So on the one hand, I want to disagree with this idea that like it's like an exclusive activity to fight in the streets. It certainly was not only young men on the streets, and certainly it wasn't only people with like citizenship or white skin privilege. In fact, what I saw, like the most actively participating people, like at the very front, were immigrants. Fighting against the police, like, you know, the anarchists with like citizenship and like, you know, like within a certain age range were like not like the most, you know, they weren't like leading the charges or anything heroic like that. But yeah, there's lots of reasons to choose not to do it. And that I think we really need to talk about how diversity of tactics isn't seen as like a ladder. You know, there's like the light tactics, which aren't really illegal or only a little bit illegal. And then there's the really hard tactics that like the braver people do. This thing worked. We were able to take over that space in this way because we found a sort of complementarity. We allowed the struggle to exist as an ecosystem, right? In which each of us played our part. Each of us had a niche and we became like one big collective animal. What the people throwing rocks weren't more important than the people who were staying there like cheering and shouting or people who were like helping the injured folks. So it was the fact that everyone came together in that way and didn't leave but supported each other that made us for that day stronger than the state. And that had really important consequences over the next months and years. We're in a situation in Barcelona where pretty much any time we want, maybe there's only 10 or 20 of us, we can take over a plaza and have a meeting Maybe we can even block a street as a protest with just 30 or 40 people. Because we're not just 30 or 40 people. We have all of this collective strength that we've built up. And that's directly related to our ability to take over space and to fight for space. So many of the things that we do that are liberating, so many of these projects that come out of these anti-capitalist movements are based on being able to create like a small bubble of autonomy or a liberated space. All the social centers and the libraries and the workshops. And there's one really good example of that that's quite recent. And then I'll stop my part of the presentation and we can have a discussion, which happened in May of 2014, May of last year. Canvies is a social center in Barcelona that had been squatted for a long time. And at one point, the city decided to evict it. Like I mentioned, the sort of squatting movement had you know, become weaker for a while, and it was more easy for the states to evict all these squatted social centers. This one had a lot of support, but finally they decided that it was the moment. They went ahead and evicted it. That same night, there was a protest of just 1,000 people. It was raining. Catalan people don't like rain, so 1,000 is actually quite an impressive number. And really only like 50 people like started a riot by like breaking off from the march and like attacking a media van and like starting to make some barricades. And then like some more people came over. About 200 people participated in that riot, and that lasted an hour. So that's a huge difference, which shows like this increase in collective knowledge about how to hold the streets, how to hold space by like running around in these small groups, making confrontations but not staying too long so that the police couldn't surround you, and then going into these popular neighborhoods with smaller streets. We have more interaction with like regular people in the neighborhood, and it's also harder for the police to bring in their riot vans, which is one thing that they use very well in Barcelona on the big streets to break through barricades with their riot vans. And that first night, it was just like 200 people, and it lasted an hour, which is actually a long time to hold the streets against the police. And then we faced the next problem, which is up to that point, for probably decades in Catalonia, riots had only ever been like a cathartic experience, right? Like catharsis, like getting these emotions off your chest. So it's like one day of, you know, you fight, you have this empowering experience, and then you go to sleep happy, and you wake up the next day and you go back to your job, you go back to the misery of daily life under the capitalist system. And not so much is built out of that in the long term. But this time people took like the very intelligent step of organizing a combative protest to try to take the space back that next day. And already the city government started demolishing it. They had like a big, like one of these big like caterpillar tractor things, like demolishing the building. And people, more and more people came until they were able to push the police out and take the building. And the big caterpillar was set on fire and it was burning for hours. And people saw this all over. And then in different neighborhoods all across the city that night, people started setting fires. Banks, dumpsters, whatever. And that completely changed the psychological atmosphere in the entire city, because not just the anarchists, not just the people reading Barcelona indie media or like whatever Twitter feed talks about riots these days. I don't do that shit. Everyone in the city realized that that we were in a way a state of war, right? Because you had these police helicopters flying over the city for hours and hours and hours until at least like 3 a.m. with their searchlights, trying to catch these people who were like setting fires in all the different neighborhood, unsuccessful, not catching anybody. And so then, like this gave like a new atmosphere to like what people had seen in the news about like, you know, these riots, for Canvies. And so on Wednesday, on the third night, people weren't scared away by this, fighting. There were, more than 10,000 people, in the streets that night participating in this rioting. And that time it lasted all night long. Police weren't able to stop it. It went into the small streets and just kept going. Immediately after that, because before that the mayor had taken a really hard line, like, you know, you're being irresponsible, there can be no dialogue if there's violence, blah, 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 like using a criminalizing discourse. And after Wednesday, the police realized that they couldn't stop this, that they couldn't win. They had lost, basically, in the streets. So immediately after that, the mayor apologized and unevicted the social center. It had been half demolished, which is actually kind of cool because, you know, before it was sort of like a dingy punk building, which wasn't so nice to go into. And now it has like a, you know, an indoor part and then like an open air plaza for like film screenings and stuff. So they sort of gave us a nice remodeling. And yeah, so they canceled the eviction of the social center. So that's still there.
that social center because people could take to the streets and fight in this way. And again, there were more forms of participation. Lots of neighbors, for example, were like cheering, or sometimes they get mad. They're like, oh, you idiots. Like, don't, like, the street is too small. Like, don't let the fire on our street. Like, light the fire on the bigger street because the smoke will just come up into our windows. And so some people would say like, well, we need to light this fire because the police are coming. And other people would be like, okay, sorry. And so there was like, you know, this dialogue. It wasn't just all like, you know, there was conflict, but it was good. People were willing to communicate. And in other instances, people gave folks clothes so they could change their clothes and escape from the police, or like come into their houses to hide, or like throw down fireworks. And like, I'm talking like big Spanish fireworks, like these like freaking rockets to shoot at the police. Like people are like, oh, saving these for San Juan, but like, here you go, please shoot these at the cops. So it was like this amazing, amazing situation. And like, because of that, we have like this, you know, we still have this one social center, but really all of the occupied spaces in Barcelona are a bit safer because of this. It recently came out that another social center, El Banco Expropiat, which is like a squatted bank, which is really, really active, really popular, has a lot of support from the neighborhood. The kind of VS building is owned by the transportation company, so it's easier for the state to decide not to evict this. But the El Banco Expropiat is owned by a private bank. Right? And they wanted to evict them. It's a bank that's not based in Barcelona, so they don't really care about questions of social conflict and riots in Barcelona. They wanted their property back. It turned out that the city government was secretly paying the bank not to evict this squat because they were afraid of more riots like this. So these methods of struggle actually work. Not only that, they're essential to do all of the other things that we want to do in our movements, to have free spaces, to put communal relationships into practice. At the same time, also plenty of criticism need to be made about how it's done up to this point. Like I was trying to do, talking about viewing struggle as an ecosystem rather than the sort of like hierarchy of tactics from like cool, dangerous ones to like the less important ones. So yeah, there's definitely always much more to learn and lots of changes that need to be made in how we struggle. But often like the sort of collective wisdom of these collective growing processes on their own show us that these more combative and illegal tactics are necessary, and they do need to be a part of our struggles. Yeah, I mean, there's so much more that can be talked about in terms of like the social movements in Barcelona, like the movement against austerity, against privatization of healthcare, the repression happening now. They're using the anti-terrorism law against anarchists there. In the last 2 years, 68 anarchists have been arrested, accused of terrorism, and that's a big question. Like, how do you break it out of that enclosure? Because in the end, repression is an enclosure, trying to isolate us, make people scared of us. How do you maintain all these contacts and talk with more and more people? Like, you know, hey, we're the terrorists, without like falling into like this discourse of inocentismo, like innocentism, like saying no, we're innocent. Because if you say we're not terrorists, you're still reinforcing this category that the state uses. What you're saying is, well, other people are terrorists, and other people should be repressed in this way. So we've been trying now to, on the one hand, continue with all of our activities, to not get exhausted or frightened by this repression, and to break the enclosure, to continue to win support from other people and to challenge other people to come out in the streets in solidarity with terrorists. And so deconstruct this anti-terrorism politics, which, just the last little point, is very interesting to note. As far as I can tell, like the main countries that had a really developed anti-terrorism politics before George Bush in the United States made it into the sort of like new global paradigm after 2001 were Spain and Germany. And there really was like a direct continuity between like the politics of exception, which is fundamental to fascism, this fascist jurisprudence that carried on under democracy. It was a way for democracy to preserve a part of fascism, which is like this idea of exceptionalism, these exceptional circumstances in which we can use harsher forms of repression against these enemies of civilization, these enemies of society, while still maintaining all the good parts of democracy, good from the point of view of the state, right? Getting people to participate in their own subjugation and exploitation, spreading this idea of social peace, that everything's fine here, that, you know, this is like a nice, happy country, and if you're concerned about things, you can donate to these NGOs that will help people in the poorer countries where bad things happen. So that's kind of one of the big projects now, is how to help society at large deconstruct these anti-terrorism politics. Yeah, like I said, there's always more to talk about, but I'm going to stop my formal part of the presentation now so that we can discuss these things. If you have questions, experiences from Stockholm that you want to add, things that you want to dispute or argue at all. And again, thank you all for coming, and thanks to the Cafe 44 folks for organizing this.
So how is the movement right now, like after the last years of, like, I guess, race repression? Like, how is it going? How?
Tired. Yeah, tired. Yeah. A little bit lost. Stopped. Like, it's kind of like stopped. Like, you're sort of like, okay. Or like, there were like a couple of years of like extreme lucidity. Like, these are the revolutionary possibilities of the moment. And you're like debating with all your comrades. And like, we should do this. No, we should do this. And now it's sort of like, all right, like, what now? And I think there's like a direct relationship between the anti-terrorism repression, which is exhausting, and the limits of imagination. The fact that nowadays we don't imagine a world without the state and without capitalism, and that makes it so that, like, even like if you get to a point like in Canvias or like in the Greek insurrection, like what do we do after we've burned everything was the title of a very interesting article sort of criticizing this. Like 100 years ago, revolutionaries talked about what revolution meant. They talked about what the society they wanted to build would look like. And I'm definitely not advocating creating blueprints of that society, which just leads to dogmatic infighting and I think is an authoritarian way of thinking. But definitely imagine, like, the practice, the activity, the process of imagining what anarchy would look like in practice is necessary. Otherwise, we get to this point where we just sort of stop. But then, the main connection I wanted to make was between the anti-terrorism repression on the one hand and the rise of these left-wing parties on the other. So we're sort of, in a crisis mode, and we can't take as much initiative because of all this repression and exhaustion. And so now, like, the left-wing parties can come along and offer easy solutions and, like, okay, well, none of that worked, but if you vote for us, like, we'll fix everything. And that's really gone hand in hand. Mm. So at the moment, there's a lot of, like, collective force that's still there, collective strength and collective experiences, but no momentum, sort of lack of clear directions and growth and, like, populism, even like among anarchists, like sort of more populist solutions, like not creating an anarchist party, but creating these anarchist mass organizations that will just do like basic recruitment, like with like marketing techniques without much content, without like a radical social critique. Not too optimistic.
Yeah, you talked about these parties, like where about Podemos, Syriza's twin, or whatever, social democrats in new form. But I wonder, like, this is maybe not that relevant, but how do you think it will go? Will it go the same way as Greece with nothing changing really, or just more repression? Or will it go like, well, at least austerity will be minimized or like lowered?
Even if they do win, which they're not forecasted to win now, I just don't think that there's the capital to be invested in like these sort of low return activities like funding the social welfare state. So I think Podemos would reach the exact same limitations that Syriza reached, which is that like governments can't really make these promises because like the money is not theirs. So the ones who control that money are the ones who sort of set that agenda. And so Podemos wouldn't be able to end austerity because austerity is coming down from, it's out of their hands. States aren't self-sufficient in their finances these days. A lot of small changes could be made. I mean, like the new progressive mayor of Barcelona can like slow down evictions of what kind of people? Of people who have at one point had the money to get a mortgage, right? To take out a bank loan to get a house. So that's definitely not addressing the situation of like the most marginalized people in society. And it also means that this quite powerful movement of people who were stopping evictions with direct action is now sort of paralyzed and just sort of waiting for like, you know, the great progressive mayor to fix things. Another great example comes from Valencia, where this activist left-wing party also won the elections. For a long time, the Popular Party, the Conservative Party, had been in power in Valencia, and they were planning to destroy a large part of El Cabañal, which is like one of the poorest neighborhoods in Valencia. A huge part of the residents there are Roma people or immigrants. And so their plan was to build an avenue through the neighborhood and destroy half of the neighborhood. And this new political party, they delivered on the promise. They canceled that plan, but they immediately put in a new plan for the aggressive gentrification of the neighborhood, bringing in students and artists and hipsters. And it's very interesting the way that they started doing that was to co-opt a feminist discourse about violence against women in an institutional way, saying that basically to justify bringing a lot of police into the neighborhood, saying that there's a lot of violence against women in the neighborhood, which is true of that neighborhood and every single other neighborhood in Valencia, but it was useful to say it here and easy because it's the least white neighborhood. And so that speaks a lot to like this racist white imaginary. And so then that's how they justify, like a progressive way of justifying sending a bunch of police into the neighborhood to harass all the non-white people and start kicking them out, and really shows like the dangers in when parts of our social movements get institutionalized, like how much stronger feminism, for example, is when it's not institutionalized as like when it is and can be like, you know, used in like, for example, like these like disgusting racist ways. Yeah. So again, like speaking about the necessity of like maintaining total independence from the state and not participating in these institutionalization efforts.
About the 68 anarchists that are in prison, how long are they first? Yeah. And how much is the repression? Because I saw that some anarchists in Madrid just had an information table like this, and some were in court.
Yeah.
So how is the biggest the repression and what terms are they?
Yeah, yeah. The 68, they're not all in prison. Most of them are out on bail awaiting trial. That's one interesting thing, is usually when they first go before the judge, they get a very harsh treatment. And many of them are sent to preventive prison, to wait in prison until trial. And then later when it gets reviewed by different judges, they look and see that like the evidence connecting them to actual sabotage actions is pretty non-existent. So then they get released. There are two, for example, who've been locked up more than 2 years awaiting trial, and the courts just decided that they can be made to wait another 2 years. Most of them are not in prison. So, like, what that means, on the one hand, that's great, you know, they're not locked up. On the other hand, it shows that the state is actually casting a very wide net. They're arresting as many people as, like, even when they can't really justify in legalistic terms the arrests. And, like, the punishment has already started. The punishment doesn't start after the trial. My guess, it could very well be wrong. Like, so, you know, the state can always decide to do whatever the hell it wants. Maybe they'll all get sent to prison, but judging by how things have gone in the past and by the level of evidence that they have, probably most of those people will not get sent to prison after trial. Some of them probably will, and they might get very long sentences, so it's important to be supportive. But the punishment has already started. The punishment is in the fact that a lot of them have to sign in a court 3 times a week, that they don't have their passports, that they have this constant stress on them. The fact that many of the people arrested, the true reason that they were arrested is because they were supporting folks who got arrested in the earlier waves. There's one wave of repression, and then, you know, the government says this or that or the other, and then the folks who are writing them letters, visiting them in prison, raising money, will then be like arrested next. So that has like, you know, a chilling effect. And like now, you know, we're sort of all joking like, you know, will you be in Pandora 3 or Pandora 4? And, yeah, kind of like this realization, like if they want to, like they could take us all, which is what they did against the Basque movement, which was how like the Spanish state developed its anti-terrorism politics.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you all for coming. So,
thanks.
Thank you.